Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
An Erio's original.
I was born with a special gift. The ability to mentally transform any situation into the worst case scenario in my own brain. My therapist calls my gift catastrophizing. And that's why I'm uniquely qualified to scrutinize and analyze history's greatest disasters and find out who's to blame. They say history repeats itself. Not on my watch. My name is Rebecca Delgado Smith, and I am The Alarmist.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into The Alarmist, a comedy podcast where we talk about history's greatest tragedies and figure out who's to blame. Today we'll be talking about the Hillsborough Stadium disaster. As is the case with many of our episodes, this is a difficult subject, so listener discretion is advised. Here's what you need to know.
Welcome to Hillsborough. The sun has come out to greet you, and referee Ray Lewis is indicating to the teams that they will be playing in the directions in which they're set at the moment. Liverpool.
On April 15, 1989, more than 50,000 soccer fans, aka football fans, gathered to watch a semi-final match between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest at Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield, England. The cost of a standing room ticket was £6, and anyone who got their hands on one was considered lucky. On that warm and sunny Saturday afternoon at noon, the stadium opened its grounds for the 3 p.m. match, and by 2 o'clock, the grounds were starting to fill up. Liverpool supporters were allocated the north and west end entrances, Leppings Lane, with just 10 turnstiles providing access to 9,700 seats in the north stand. But by 2:15, only 12,000 fans had been able to enter the stadium, as opposed to the 20,000 that by this time had entered the corresponding semi-final game the previous year. The entrance area by the north end turnstiles was experiencing extreme bottlenecking. By 2:45 p.m., the crowd inside and outside the turnstiles had reached 5,000. Many people were sweating and short of breath. It became clear that not all the fans would be able to pass through the turnstiles before 3 p.m. In order to relieve the bottleneck of Liverpool fans trying to enter the venue before kickoff, police opened an exit gate and people rushed to get inside. In just 5 minutes, 2,000 fans passed through. The majority made their way to the central pens of the Leppings Lane end. It quickly became obvious to other spectators that pens 3 and 4 were excessively full, while the outer pens still had space with patches of concrete visible. More than 3,000 fans were funneled into a standing room only area with a safe capacity of just 1,600. This influx caused severe crushing in the pens. Fans began climbing over side fences into the relatively less packed pens to escape. At 3 p.m., the match began. Liverpool's goalkeeper could hear fans from behind him pleading for help as the situation worsened. The police at first attempted to stop fans from spilling out of the pens, some believing they were trying to invade the field. At approximately 3:05 p.m., a shot from Liverpool's Peter Beardsley hit the bar. At the same time, a crush barrier in Pen 3 gave way, causing people to fall on top of each other. The crushing was happening right in front of fans sitting in other parts of the stadium, as well as being watched on television. At 3:06 p.m., a referee stopped the game. At this point, fans were climbing the fence in an effort to escape the crush, and a small gate in the pen onto the field had been forced open. Some fans escaped through that gate, as others continued to climb over the fencing as people were spilling onto the field. Other fans inside were pulled out of the pens by fans on the stands above the pens. Those still trapped were being crushed.
But we have chaos with fans on the field, I'm afraid to say. Now, just when Liverpool supporters have had the inkling of a chance to get back into Europe, we've got problems because the police have been guiding spectators out of the end, away to my left-hand side, and some of those spectators have spilled onto the field, and one or two of them look rather the worse for drink, but clearly something has gone badly wrong at that end of the ground where the Liverpool supporters are. The game has been stopped, nothing is happening, the players are moving towards the centre circle, and the police are trying to get control of this situation once more.
In the midst of the chaos, the St. John ambulance staff performed CPR to the injured on the field, while many uninjured fans assisted the injured and tore down advertising signs to use as stretchers. In total, 96 people lost their lives and 766 were injured. Of the 96 people who died, only 14 were admitted to the hospital. Most of the victims trapped in the pens were packed so tightly that they died of compressive asphyxia while standing.
The worst disaster in British sporting history happened at the start of the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest. Police opened a 16-foot-wide gate to relieve what they called the life-threatening pressure of fans outside the ground. And 3,000 of those fans poured onto a terrace, crushing those already there. The Football Association has already launched an inquiry. The government has ordered an urgent report.
Hooliganism played no direct part in the disaster at Sheffield. Mismanagement will be the common denominator in the many ingredients to be identified at the inquiry. But there was bad humour and aggression outside the ground between police and Liverpool fans, hundreds of whom had gathered without tickets, angry that 6,000 fewer tickets had been allocated to Liverpool than to Nottingham.
The gate was opened at police direction. I am not aware of any connection between the opening of the gate and the surge on the terrace.
Whichever Liverpool fans may have made some contribution to it, they're unlikely to have been among those who died. For the dead had been among the first to enter the enclosure, to stake their place at the wire fence, and eventually to be crushed to death against it.
Fun facts, aka death stats. It took nearly 30 minutes for organizers to call for doctors and nurses via the public address system. 95 people died at or shortly after the disaster, but the 96th person died in 1993 when he was taken off life support. Of those who died, 37 were teenagers, and of the 96, 89 were male and 7 were female. 3 pairs of brothers, 1 pair of sisters, and 1 father and son died together. 26 of the dead were parents. Victims came from all walks of life, working class, middle class, wealthy, hard up, from Liverpool, the Midlands, London, and everywhere around the UK. Some of the injured were permanently disabled after the day's events. Thousands were left traumatized by what they saw.
Mr. Byrne also witnessed the Heysel Stadium tragedy at first hand. He said there was total panic today.
People were shouting for help. They were shouting to the front to open the gates, to let them be dragged out. But it seemed slow on opening the gates to get the people out because you could see that it wasn't an ordinary crush. It was... there was something wrong.
So here we are. With us today are producer Amanda Lund.
Hello, everyone.
And fact checker Chris Smith. And we're also very lucky to have our special guest with us today, Patrick Adler, who's an academic of city planning.
Hello.
Well, yeah,
and that's true.
Welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
You know, having smart friends pays off sometimes for me.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Pat, tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I'm a multidisciplinary academic. I am a researcher for the University of Toronto. I research urban economics and urban planning issues, and then I do some teaching here in LA.
And you said that you actually studied football or soccer.
You know, one of the themes of my research is how, like, people consume in cities, mm-hmm. so consumption patterns in cities. And we did an analysis of the cities that were adopting MLS teams in the United States, and it was kind of the most... I guess in Hillary Clinton's terms, like the least deplorable cities, like, so it's the most kind of blue cities, cosmopolitan cities. And basically the profile of a person in the United States who follows soccer is like kind of worldly and cosmopolitan. And the profile of someone in England would be more like traditional working class. So
Interesting. So we view soccer as a higher...
It's a highbrow sport.
Highbrow sport.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, Chris, you used to play soccer when you were a kid.
I did, with a monocle in my eye.
And a top hat.
And a top hat, yes, in my tuxedo, my soccer tuxedo.
But you had to have a chin strap for the top hat to keep it on while you ran.
And it was really hard to do headers. That's right. But in America, the working class, we're a football nation. Like, mm-hmm. football is
That's right.
a mega... A giant.
So I have to say, learning about this particular tragedy, I've had to stop listening to podcasts and stop watching a ton of documentaries because my anxiety levels are so high while learning about this. I can't imagine what it must have been like to been in this unorganized situation. So, I mean, I think we just can dive right in and start putting people up on the board. And off the bat, I mean, we need to talk about the South Yorkshire Police. According to an article on BBC, in the aftermath, the police lied about the fans being drunk. 4 days after the disaster, the Sun newspaper published its now infamous front page under the headline, "The Truth," quote unquote, "This is the truth," claiming some fans had, quote, picked the pockets of victims and had urinated on a woman police officer who was trying to help the dying. Other regional and national newspapers published similar allegations, although less prominently. This was not true. Subsequent investigations would go on to dispel this drunken hooligan fan myth. So, right away, the police got defensive and just started victim blaming. Duckinfield, who was the superintendent of the police chief, first thing he did was start victim blaming, mm-hmm. which is, to me, that's a red flag, mm-hmm. right?
They say if you point one finger at at somebody, you're usually pointing three fingers at yourself.
That's right. And one finger up at God?
And one finger up at God. Yeah, if you have the sort of like...
If your thumb is up.
But I guess, like, just in terms of the police, they don't come off as... Great. We were also watching another documentary where they were saying they immediately started asking if the people involved were drunk or drinking that day. So they were already kind of interested in learning about how can this not be made to be my fault?
Right.
And how can it be? It's the hooligans, basically. Yeah. The hooligan blaming.
Hillsborough Stadium Disaster Inquiry Report is the report of an inquiry which was overseen by Lord Justice Taylor and was published in January of 1990. The Taylor Report found that the main reason for the disaster was the failure of police control. Now, there had been a recent personnel change, and this is according to Wiki. Just Wikipedia.
Does Wikipedia have police? Like, because you can put whatever you want on Wikipedia, right? Do they have?
We're all the Wiki police.
Are we? Yeah. That's right. It's a group.
It's like anarcho-capitalism.
Oh, cool.
Which is something you can find out on Wikipedia.
So according to WikiPolice,
us, aka us,
the police presence at the previous year's FA Cup semifinal, also between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest and also at Hillsborough Stadium, had been overseen by Chief Superintendent Brian L. Mole. Now, Mole had supervised numerous police deployments at the stadium in the past. But in October of 1988, probationary PC in Mole's F division, so another like a younger cop, was handcuffed, photographed, and stripped by fellow officers in a fake robbery as a hazing prank. Mm. Okay, so this happened.
So these police are bad guys, like basically is what you're
saying? No, no. What I'm saying is, aside from, so Mole's been the one who's running the stadium and for years has overseen the police activity in the stadium. Mm-hmm. Now, a side incident, this young cop gets hazed by these other cops, mm-hmm. and this gets reported. And the four officers that do this are resign, and then seven were disciplined over the incident. Chief Superintendent Mole himself was to be transferred to Barnsley Division for career development reasons, quote. That's what they said. But what essentially was happening, according to this 30 for 30 doc on the Hillsborough disaster, which I highly recommend, Mole was being transferred even though he didn't have any knowledge of the prank prior to the incident. He was said to have been an actually effective superintendent, but this situation just happened to happen in October of 88, and so he was being transferred.
That's where Duckenfield comes in. He's a newbie, is what you're saying.
Well, like a fresh duckling. The transfer was to be done with immediate effect on March 27, 1989. Again, this happens April 15th. Meanwhile, Hillsborough was accepted as the FA Cup semifinal venue on March 20th. And the first planning meeting for the semifinal took place on March 22nd and was attended by the newly promoted chief superintendent, David Duckenfield, not by Mole, because Mole's on his way out.
Right.
No known minutes exist of the meeting, although Mole could have been assigned the semifinals match planning despite his transfer. That was not done. This left planning for the semifinal match to Duckenfield, who had never commanded a sellout football match before and who had, quote, very little, if any, training or personal experience on how to do so. There's even some footage saying that he didn't know who the teams were. He didn't really have any knowledge of actual football, much less how to run a stadium that was sold out.
So it's kind of like having any of us do it.
That's like, literally,
in terms of experience,
yeah.
Correct.
Although, honestly, you and Rebecca, I think, would do a better job.
Oh, wow.
I just met you, but
I know, that's so nice.
There are two visiting teams. So something you need to know about this particular cup is that they would have two visiting teams play in what is essentially a neutral pitch or field or whatever, or a stadium.
Yes, you're right. All of the cities that the people were coming from, the fans were coming from, were about an hour to an hour and a half commute. Mm-hmm. Another huge failure by police, which we've put the police up on the board.
Yeah, so far up on the board, South Yorkshire Police and... I put Duckenfield up there.
Yeah, absolutely. He definitely needs to go up there. And now we're going to talk to Phil Scratton, author of Hillsborough, The Truth, and Professor Emeritus in the School of Law at Queen's University in Belfast, about the South Yorkshire Police Department.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us about this. My question really is, would you place the blame more on Duckenfield himself or the South Yorkshire Police as a whole?
I think it's important to really understand the complexity of Duckenfield's appointment as the match commander on the day. He had only been in charge of policing two previous matches, games, at that stadium, and he was inexperienced. In the film Hillsborough, we demonstrate the reason, very clear reason, why he was given so little lead-in time. There had been a scandal within the South Yorkshire Police Force, and his predecessor, who had experience of being match commander at Hillsborough, was removed from the job. Duckenfield was parachuted in, but he had an experienced team around him. And when he was caught in the headlights in the police control box, and he could see that there was a crowd outside that was becoming quite dangerous, when he made that decision to open the gate, you would have expected his senior officers, who had a long experience of policing that stadium, would have intervened, and they didn't. So the issue is that whilst he, of course, was responsible for the decision to open the gates, while, of course, he was responsible for the lie that he immediately told that went all around the world, there were others, the match, not only the match commander, the ground commander, the commander outside the ground, all of those senior officers who had experience of policing Hillsborough and who contributed through their own negligence and neglect to the situation, the escalation of the situation. So, yes, Duckenfield had to be held responsible for his own failings. But there were others who failed very much so as well on the day.
You can hear the full interview on Thursday's Aftermath episode. Okay, back to it.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Another huge failure by police was, according to BBC, in this interim report on August 4th, 1989, after the disaster, Lord Justice Taylor wrote that the key element of police control at fault was the failure to close off the tunnel leading to pens 3 and 4 once gate C had been opened. Gate C was the entrance gate. He went on to criticize police for their failure to handle the buildup of fans outside the ground properly and their slow reaction to the unfolding disaster. Now, let's take a moment to kind of like talk about how this is all happening.
My dissertation is also on music festivals. So it's a similar sort of thing, but usually with crowd control at sporting events and music festivals, you want to kind of manage the crowd and like distribute the crowd across multiple areas so that there's not this like psychic pressure on this one point where everyone really wants to get in. And
right.
As it was described to me, that's exactly what happened. Like, the police were just there, and there's a lot of, like, angry Liverpoolians staring down at them. And so I think the kind of social pressure, based on my reading, was, like, a big factor, where, like, it's, like, tens or thousands of people. Thousands of people?
Thousands. Yeah, thousands. Yes.
Thousands of people against a few police officers. I think that's a tough call.
For me also, it's a timing thing, right? So there were a lot of factors that led to this exact thing, which were The game was about to start at 3 o'clock. The groups are outside and they're looking at their watches and they're saying, we got to get in. The crowd, you know, the match is about to start. Now, this gate C that they're talking about, there's pressure that's building up into these tunnels and people as people are trying to force their way in. And the police are radioing back to Duckenfield saying, we got to open up gate C and let people in because the crowds outside are really getting crushed inside and outside. So Duckenfield, like, they go back and forth. And finally, Duckenfield says, okay, open up gate C. Now, once gate C is open, 2,000 people come in a matter of, like, 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And there weren't any signs distributing the crowds to go to the outside pens. People just went right in. They saw the tunnel and they walked straight down because those were the two pens. Once the pens 3 and 4 were full, they should have closed the tunnel and not allowed more people to go in there.
And by pens, I don't really know what that means. Does that mean just the area in the bleacher seats, or what are pens?
So pens are standing room only sections that are right by the field. So what it is, okay. it's just what it is. It's like a pen, or it's like basically imagine cages lined up next to each other that are actually meant to prevent going from one cage to another.
Why this particular game? Why did this happen on this particular game? Was there a reason just that there were so many people? Or
what happened was that because and we'll come back to Duckenfield because there's a few things that I want to say about how he acted afterwards. But we can jump into this hooligan idea. Mm-hmm. Okay. So hooliganism, according to Wikipedia, is disorderly, violent, or destructive behavior perpetrated by spectators at football events. It normally involves conflict between gangs. Certain clubs have long-standing rivalries with other clubs, and hooliganism is associated with the matches between them. According to Hillsborough Untold, in the 1980s, hooliganism at football matches was frequent. It was ugly, and it was dangerous. 39 Juventus fans, I think that's a team, had been killed at the Heysel Stadium in Belgium just 4 years before the Hillsborough disaster. It provoked sanctions against English football, with all of the teams banished from European competition for the remainder of the decade. And then what they started doing was segregating fans. So the Liverpool fans were told to come to the north and the west end, and the Nottingham Forest fans were told to go to the south and east. The Liverpool fans were told to go through this particular area that had 10 turnstiles. So this is 10 turnstiles for 9,700 people.
So was it mostly the Liverpool fans who got trampled?
It was only the Liverpool fans.
Oh my God, that ratio is just as bad as the 5 bathrooms to 5,000 people on the poop cruise.
Well,
we just did the carnival poop cruise.
Someone was saying that it had to be 27 people per minute had to go through the turnstiles in order to get there on time. And then the police start saying, oh, it's because people were late. Oh, it's because people were drunk. But really, it was that they couldn't get through these turnstiles quick enough. People outside, they don't know what's happening inside, right? They don't know that there's crushing happening. All they're thinking is, I need to get in before the game. Push. Like, let's go. What's the holdup?
So, Pat, as someone who knows a little bit about this, is there some sort of, like, oversight committee who helps with the safety when you're making these sorts of decisions? Or would it all be up to the people who own the stadium?
1989 is a little ways away in terms of, like, lawsuits around these things and insurance policies. It's like the kind of like liability side of like mass events has gotten a lot more sophisticated, and that's pushed a lot of like rationalization of how these things get managed. So I think in a modern context, first of all, the like local stadium wouldn't have that much control. There would be some corporation with experience executing these events, and they would be in charge. And I'm not, I mean, maybe I'm describing something that's not even how they do it now at the FA Cup, but I'm pretty sure there's some kind of more specialization. So you're not sort of relying on local police forces or you know, local organizers to do everything right. You're relying on specialists who go from stadium to stadium and, right. and have protocols in place.
But that was not the case, you're saying, in 1989.
I mean, it was just a much less, like, I think we can be rightfully scared about how, like, corporatized everything has become. But part of the, like, silver lining there is that, like, a company like Live Nation, which handles a lot of music festivals or live events, is really smart at crowd control. And they've got experience doing it, and they also have procedures that sort of work. So
because they can take on the liability, is that what you're saying? Or
so why are they so smart? Because they don't want to get sued.
Right.
So it starts with the liability, but the kind of liability puts the conditions in place where they're going to behave a little bit better.
And they're also competent. They know they probably have, like, tons of people helping them figure out the best way to do this. So who else can we throw up on the board?
Well, I was just gonna say maybe. Maybe we can blame no corporate daddies.
No.
It's going to be great for my reputation.
I would say Chris corporate says no corporate mommies, daddies. Because a mommy would also be protect. Really good at coordinating.
A lack of corporate mommies. We're
It's hard, though, because this is like we're getting in a you can't really do the time machine thing where you're like, if only they had had something that didn't exist back then. But were you leaning?
But this is not the first time that this sort of thing had happened at the stadium. So
that we should put the people running the stadium on the board, right? And are you wanting to also put hooligans on the board?
I think we should.
We have to.
Well, here's the thing. Hooliganism, we need to put up on the board just because that was what was where the blame was placed. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree now, what has it been, almost 30 years later, that was not what actually happened. You know, let's just put it up there.
So hooligans, they took a lot of the blame early on, is what you're saying.
Well, it was part of the myth.
Right. And so, but let's put them on there for now because, you know, I feel like, while the court of public opinion has made their determination, the alarmist people need to make our own.
That's true.
And that is the reason they decided to separate the people from Liverpool from the Nottingham group.
Yes.
So past bad behavior.
Or put up these pens.
Yeah.
So past bad behavior.
So past
hooliganism.
Yeah.
So we have hooliganism up on the board now, and I want to talk about the stadium's design and the designers. The turnstiles, they were said to be inadequate to process the crowd safely, and the rate of entry was insufficient, as we said, to prevent dangerous buildup outside the ground. Implementing the pens as security measures meant that for many, there was no escape from the crush. The pens' officially combined capacity was 2,200. It was later discovered that this should have been reduced to 1,600, as crush barriers installed 3 years earlier did not meet official safety standards. Mm.
Do we have a name for the stadium owners?
Well, we could put the stadium administration, which was Sheffield Wednesday Football Club.
Or the designers?
Were pens outlawed after this?
Yeah, this, they said that everyone needed a seat.
Terrible.
Okay, I'm going to do a little research, get a name of a designer, or I'm going to get that.
Well, there was Archibald Leitch, L-I-E-T-C-H. He's Britain's foremost football architect. In total, he was commissioned to design part or all of more than 20 stadiums in the UK and Ireland. But this was between 1899 and 1939. And he was the one who designed the stadium.
Mm. When were the pens added, I wonder?
Like recently, right?
The pens were added after the incident in Belgium.
So I'm reluctant to blame Archie because
that's why
for me
it's more the administration. Let's talk a little bit about that. This isn't the first incident that happens in the stadium. According to Wikipedia, a crush occurred at the Leppings Lane end of the ground during the 1981 semi-final between Tottenham Hotspur and Wolverhampton Wanderers. After hundreds more spectators were permitted to enter the terrace than could safely be accommodated, resulting in 38 injuries, including broken arms, legs, and ribs. Police believe that there had been a real chance of fatalities had swift action not been taken, and recommended that the club reduce its capacity. But the incident nonetheless prompted Sheffield Wednesday to alter the layout at the Leppings Lane end, dividing the terrace into three separate pens to restrict sideways movement. So now not only were you not able to go onto the fields, but now you were encased. This 1981 change and other later changes to the stadium invalidated the stadium's safety certificate. The safety certificate was never renewed, and the stated capacity of the stadium was never changed.
I have something for us here. I think I just found this article, The Roots of Football Hooliganism. With the increasing frequency of such incidents, meaning incidents of hooliganism in the 1970s, the Minister for Sport recommended that all grounds should be divided into manageable pens in order to assist with crowd control.
Who was the Minister of Sport?
I don't know.
Ooh, that sounds like a fact checker job.
Yes. So in October of 1970, the FA advised all league clubs.
So right now we have Duckinfield, South Yorkshire Police, No Corporate Mommies, Past Hooliganism, and Hillsborough Stadium Administration. We can maybe talk about Graham Kelly. Graham Kelly is the Football Association chief executive. So he is the guy who's in charge and of the stadium. And according to an article I found on The Independent, the former FA chief executive Graham Kelly's initial draft report about the disaster, written 2 days afterwards, and if you read it, you will find no sign within its 6 pages that he was looking to investigate how the venue, which did not even have a safety certificate, had been chosen. So he's the one who's in charge of finding a stadium for these semifinal events.
Yeah, throw him on the board. Graham Kelly.
I mean, these things, these site selection things, whether it's the Olympics or, you know, where is some big company going to go? Not to cast any more aspersions than this guy already deserves. They are fraught with corruption. Okay.
Oh.
Anytime someone is in charge, has power to decide where something goes, there's the opportunity for bribery. And
who knows? So let's put Graham Kelly up on the board.
Kelly's up. I also have, we have a little bit of a issue here because there was the Minister of Sport. There was a change in the Minister of Sport in 1970.
Ooh. Wow, okay.
So it was Dennis Howell ushered in 1970, and then Eldon Griffiths took over. So I'm not sure which of these guys came up with a pen idea, but I'm going to kind of dig a little bit more.
Gotcha.
Who invented the pen as an idea?
I mean,
is that what we're trying to understand?
And isn't it also like, who or like how did we come to treat other human beings as animals to go in pens?
It's a great question. How did we get to this?
Okay, I have a few kind of off the wall ideas.
Me too.
Okay.
Let's listen.
Okay, so I've got like the sanctity of soccer.
Okay.
So it's like, we got to start this thing on this time. This is really important. So that's like the organizers.
Yes. And that goes back to Duckinfield because they asked him to push back the start, and he had the power
yeah.
to push the start back.
I like that, though, the sanctity of soccer, that this was so important. It was, in a way, more important than the safety of the these quote-unquote hooligans.
And the same thing for the people at the back, rushing to get in so they don't miss a second. And soccer itself is just so action-packed and intense. It's not like
too good
baseball.
Of a sport.
Too good. We don't deserve it. We can't control ourselves.
It is fun. I also was thinking, you know, man's hubris.
Classic.
Classic one. My question is, why didn't David Duckinfield just say, I think I'm over my head. I don't know football. I don't know how this works. I need help. I also want to talk about tonic immobility.
Now, this is a word I've never heard.
Tonic immobility is a natural state of paralysis that animals enter, often called animal hypnosis. This is about fooling predators into leaving you alone, a strategy which is millions of years old. And that is exactly what happened to Duckenfield. According to witnesses that were with him, it was like something happened that he couldn't make a call. He waited so long to do anything about the problem. No emergency response was ever put into play by Duckenfield. And on top of that, he had the police stand in a line as a barrier to stop the other fans from coming into the field.
Because they were most afraid of people coming onto the field and ruining their little soccer match.
Yes. So that, to me, that tonic immobility of like not knowing what to do when panic strikes, I think that we can all relate to it. Mm-hmm. It's something that has probably happened to us all. I as a person tend to fight. That's my
deer in the headlights syndrome, right? What do you do?
I mean, do you have any others that you'd like?
Well, the thing that I was going to add, which it's a nice little like mixer with that like tonic.
Ooh.
Immobility. Sorry. It's this like command structure. So in some of the analysis that I had read, there is a very strong hierarchical command structure where, you know, Mr. Duckenfieldworth was in charge of everything. And the idea is that his word, which, you know, wasn't based on much, went. And right. So, for instance, there was 5 minutes, this like crushing happened over the course of like 5 minutes, and there was all sorts of opportunity for people to intervene. But then there was not a like bureaucratic culture or structure where you could do that until it was too late.
Okay, so there always comes a time in every episode where we have to start crossing things and people off the list.
So, Chris, will you walk us through what we currently have on the board?
Yes. Duckenfield, South Yorkshire Police, no corporate mommy, hooliganism, Hillsborough Stadium admin, Graham Kelly.
Graham Kelly is the FA chief, the Football Association chief.
Gotcha. The sanctity of soccer, man's hubris, tonic immobility, rigid command structure, and I couldn't find the minister of sports. It's either Eldon Griffiths or Dennis Howell.
Well, why don't we just put up the minister of sports and you know who you are? So right off the bat, what do you think we can take off? Because I'm having a hard time.
I have a suggestion for what we should take off. I think in honor of the people who were killed in this disaster and the people who were so wrongly represented by the initial sort of outpouring of the press, I think we should take off hooliganism.
100%. Like
we should absolve the fans.
Yeah. Take that off. What else are you thinking, Pat?
I know that, you know, I basically generated this, but just for my own reputation, I'm going to take off no corporate mommy.
Oh, yeah? Mm. Tell us why.
I would say that obviously an absence of expertise plagued this event and can explain this. And you could come by expertise through a corporate structure specialization. You could come by other ways.
Uh-huh.
That's very fair.
And I think in the spirit of the political season, I'm not going to... you know, tip my cards and say that you can only have expertise through like this corporate structure. So I'm just going to say a little bit of expertise would have helped, but
I love that. Okay. All right.
No, let's take it off. You make a really good case. I think we can take man's hubris off as much as I don't want to, but
because especially when you're talking about Duckenfield, just from the very little I know about him, it doesn't seem like he had this ego and that was the reason it happened. It seems more that he was inept and in over his head.
Yeah. I mean, but with that comes an ego. If you can't back down, if you can't be like, I'm not the man for the job, that there's ego involved in that, isn't there?
That's true, but it also could be more fear.
That's true. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Man's hubris is out.
Okay.
Duckenfield is in.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do think that between Duckenfield and the South Yorkshire Police, one of those should go.
I think the police, because they are, you know, and this goes back to the rigid command structure I think they're taking orders from Duckinfield. A few of them were like radioing in and trying to, you know, solve the problem, but they couldn't do anything until they got the approval from Duckinfield.
But go counterpoint.
On. Yes.
Who installed this Duckinfield?
It wasn't Duckinfield himself.
Wasn't it the police who said Mole's got to go?
That's right.
Because he did his little hijinks, which he didn't even do.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm the mole. I'm Mole's mole on this podcast.
So you're saying that the police has to stay on there.
So to me, the police and rigid command structure are almost one thing. There obviously were some issues going on here.
So cut off. So should I cut out rigid command structure?
To me, you could absorb that into, into the Yorkshire police.
Yeah. Now, sanctity of soccer. What do you guys think?
I don't know. To me, the sanctity of soccer puts out just as much good in the world as it does bad.
I'm fine with taking that off. I just want to say, PSA, it's not that big of a deal. I watch a lot of sports. They're really fun.
I'm with you.
It's not worth
it. It's a game. It's a game. Yeah, let's
it's
all remember.
It's the semifinals, too. It wasn't the finals.
I think that we can take tonic immobility out.
We didn't get too much into like just the physics of these events. And like actually the basis of like these things happening is like this really kind of dynamic system we were talking about a little bit where you know like really far away something happens, they have no idea what's going on, they create this like it's like when that many people are close together they behave like a fluid. Mm-hmm. So it creates like a ripple in a pond and then it just rips through this fluid of people and then, you know, people literally don't have room in their lungs to breathe. So it wasn't actually immobility that actually caused this. It was this active dynamic process. So
right.
Think jeez.
I mean, now you're getting into physics.
Sorry, man.
Oh, yeah, man. Molecular.
But look, I still think that it was man-made. Like, if there had been procedures that were an effective structure of what to happen, yes. What would happen. It wouldn't have mattered if there was any kind of tonic immobility.
Ooh.
So I think the organization is more to blame than just the human that human aspect. The Ministry of Sports, I think.
He created those pens.
I know.
Ooh. I know, but the pens, it's like the pens were fine sometimes. It's the mismanagement and of the stadium that made it deadly.
I agree.
I'm going to push back just a little bit because I think to Pat's point from earlier, when you put people in pens, they start to act like people who belong in pens. Mm. And so I think that there's a whole police fan dynamic where there's just an absence of sort of respect as we see in how they described the massacre afterwards.
I absolutely agree with you, but there were also games where this didn't happen. At this point, they had been in there for, what, 5 or 6 years?
Yeah. I'm with you guys. I'm going to take off the Minister of Sports, Alden Griffiths. He's off the hook.
Okay, what did Graham Kelly do again?
Graham Kelly was the one who picked that stadium, even though it didn't have a certificate.
Okay, I think he's not as culpable as the police and the administration.
Okay, he should have done his research, but he's going off. He skates away.
I mean, so because it wasn't really like the architecture wasn't to blame. It was like there are way too many people allowed in this space.
And only 10 turnstiles. Like they should have thought it through.
Yeah.
That to me comes down to the operation of Hillsborough Stadium, which was, what do we say, the Sheffield Wednesday Football Club or whoever we have up on the board.
We just
for
have
that.
Hillsborough Stadium admin.
It's like them and the police, to me, are the two right. real baddies. Contenders.
Yeah, the bad boys.
Can we narrow it down to that?
It's got to be Duckinfield. I mean, I think the theory of the case for me is that there are just way too many people in the stadium. It wasn't that like the stadium itself was inferior.
Not up to right.
Yeah, but the choice to do the West and North stands.
Oh, okay. But then,
and assigning the Liverpool fans to that thing.
So if they'd switched it, would have been different?
Yes.
Oh.
So I forgot to read this. Hold on. This is really interesting. What everyone should have been more concerned about was the impact that the allocation and segregation would have on the turnstile configuration. Hillsborough had 83 turnstiles in 1989. Every single one would have been for an event with a capacity crowd would have been used for an event with a capacity crowd of 54,000. But with a myopic focus on segregation at all costs, the club, in full view of the police, mm-hmm. divided the number of turnstiles so that Nottingham Forest fans had 60, that's 72% of the total means of entry, whilst Liverpool fans had only 23, that's 28%. Even worse, all 24,256 Liverpool ticket holders were required to enter the ground at Leppings Lane. So they all had to go through the same entrance.
And it's both of them. Don't you think? It's the administration and the police. Yeah.
I think we have to send them both. I just wouldn't feel good letting the administration go on this. Oh,
that's a big piece of evidence right there.
I think I want to give the big slap to Duckinfield, because as a person in charge, even though we're sending the police to the jail, I feel like as a person in charge, he deserves, oh man, just a huge slap.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Call it.
Okay. Duckinfield, you've got the big slap.
Nice.
South Yorkshire Police and the Hillsborough Stadium Administration, you're going to the alarmist jail. That was really tough. Way harder than I thought it would be. I thought it was going to be just a given that the police were going to go. Or Duckinfield.
Well, that's why you have the trial.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for joining us.
This is as fun as it should have been.
That could mean anything.
Has there ever been a better review?
When you walk through a storm.
After the Hillsborough Stadium disaster, the families campaigned for 27 years for the truth, despite lies told by senior officers, slurs in national newspapers, and an alleged police cover-up to deflect blame on the supporters. On June 28, 2017, Britain's Crown Prosecution Service announces that it has charged 6 people, including Duckinfield, with criminal offenses related to the disaster. On November 28, 2019, Duckinfield is found not guilty of gross negligence manslaughter. The Taylor report that came out after the disaster recommended that all major stadiums convert to an all-seater model and that all ticketed spectators should have seats, as opposed to some or all being obliged to stand. By the disaster's 10th anniversary in 1999, at least 3 people who survived were known to have died by suicide. Another survivor had spent 8 years in psychiatric care. There were cases of alcoholism, drug abuse, and collapsed marriages involving people who had witnessed the events. The lingering effects of the disaster were seen as a cause or contributory factor in all of these.
Think is to blame by going to thealarmistpodcast.com. Follow us at the alarmist the on Twitter, at the alarmist podcast on Instagram, or email us at thealarmistpodcast@gmail.com. Tune in next week as we'll be discussing the Astor Place riots.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.